You're listening. I almost said the coffee hour. Nope. Wrong show. Restart. Listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
It's a book club wrap-up day. We have been waiting for this one for so long. I feel like, I don't think it's actually been any longer than any other book, but I read this book immediately when it was, when we thought about it before we even announced it. So I'm so excited. Rachel, what are we doing?
We're doing Jane Eyre.
Yes!
For all of those who love your passionate vintage gothic romance novels with a lot of theology in them, this is the book for you. So originally written in published in 1847 by Charlotte Bronte under the pseudonym Currer Bell, because she didn't think she'd be accepted as a female author. Very quickly, she was accepted as a female author because this book was an absolute hit, and it continues to be a favorite today. It has a lot of perennial themes about how to overcome hardships in your past, how to learn to forgive, develop resilience, trust in God, make godly choices even when it costs you everything in the short term, and trust that, it, as happens in this wonderful book with a happy ending, that in the end, when you make those choices, it will work out, even in miraculous ways. And there are miracles that happen in this book. So this is Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. I know, Sarah, you were brand new to this book and then sort of tore through it so quickly that you have forgotten a lot of it in the 3 months since you finished it.
Yeah, that's pretty true.
Well, so we'll just stick with vague general impressions. As a newbie to this book, what did you think?
I was super excited to read this. I think it had been on some sort of list somewhere to read for a long, long time. I feel like I had started it once and I got not very far in or something, or I saw a movie. I don't know. I was introduced to it somewhere and I was like, I don't think so. This is no. And then I started reading it this time and I immediately loved it. And then it was an emotional roller coaster because the first part of the book is so dark. I'm like, I'm not prepared for this right now.
I can verify the chat thread that the three of us have. We could follow Sarah's progress to the book as she is like, what?
What is what's happening?
What? No.
It was a roller coaster. Can confirm.
Yeah. And after a while, I had to be careful to just be very vague because Erin hadn't gotten to the parts that I had gotten to. So I had to
I was like, no spoilers, Sarah.
Yeah, so I had to be very careful. Uh-huh. And then I ended up just messaging Rachel at one point. Because I had to complain about something and I knew Erin wasn't there yet, so I didn't want to spoil it. So I did the audiobook. I loved the audiobook. It was very good. It was very long. I did buy a hard copy, and these days I am totally basing my hard copy purchases on the covers of books, and I am in my cloth-covered board hardcover book era. Uh-huh. It's just, sorry, Taylor Swift reference. I don't even listen to Taylor Swift. Got that one. I'm very happy I bought the hardcover, though, because I could reference things as I was going, especially the, I don't even know how many pages of endnotes, footnotes, or whatever in the back that explained a lot of the cultural context, which was really helpful. When I came across something that I figured I should know, or some of the French, it was really helpful. And it had a whole introduction at the beginning of the surrounding vibe of the book and all of the like feminism stuff and all of the Charlotte Bronte's pen name and all of the backstory of the book. So that was really helpful too, to just kind of understand a little bit more. So let's see, general things. Mr. Rochester makes me feel a little creepy. I don't know how I totally feel about him. The like magical stuff is just kind of like, okay, really? And then also, I do remember when she finds that she's living with her cousins. I think this was the part I messaged you, Rachel, but I don't know.
Yeah.
When she's like, oh, I'm related to you. I'm like, really? of all the people that she could find to live with, she happens to be related to them. I mean, come on. This feels a little unrealistic. I mean, it was fun, but
not the insane wife in the attic. That part didn't feel that felt normal, but
finding random cousins in the middle of countryside feels a lot more unbelievable than having an insane wife hidden away in your attic for some reason. I don't know.
That's an important point to bring up. You talk about the vibe around this. This is a gothic novel. Yeah. It's a twist on the gothic novel. I mean, a gothic novel is when things happen that are uncanny. You know, these are the dark, stormy night kind of things. You could almost say that they're early forebears of magical realism as a genre, but this is less magical realism and more miraculous realism or providential realism. There's a lot of an understanding that she is completely at the mercy of God in all of these things that are happening.
Yeah.
And that it really is God who works it all out in the end.
Yeah.
You know, God who puts her on the doorstep of her only living relatives.
Come on.
And so there's a lot of providence here.
Yeah. That's true. I do love her when she's in her teaching, when she's doing all of her teaching, and like she is just in her element, doing something that she loves to do. That was a fun part. My favorite, and this is such a detail, but my favorite part was when I realized that the name STJOHN is pronounced Sinjin, because I was reading, listening to the book, and I was like, Sinjin, that's an odd name, but okay. And then I was trying to find my place in the book after I had met Sinjin, and I couldn't find it. I was like, where is this Sinjin character? And that's why I had to like look it up. I Googled, what is Sinjin? Like, oh, St. John is Sinjin. Okay.
Yeah, chalk it up to the British love of eccentric names and their persistent insistence on mispronouncing things for the sake of it.
That was a wild realization to me to finally figure out which character that was. Because I thought I was still waiting for St. John to show up. And I had already met him like 5 chapters ago.
Adventures in literature.
Yeah.
All right, Erin, apparently you were affected by the crazy wife in the attic. Tell us about your experience.
No, I absolutely. So this was the third time that I started the book, and the first time that I finished the book.
Hey,
well done, progress.
So I started reading it at least twice, and got, I don't know, somehow it was never assigned to me in high school growing up.
Same. Too much God, probably.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I was in a small town. We were fine with God.
Okay.
So, but I watched a BBC production of it at one point. Mm. However, and that I was like, okay, well, I sort of get the gist of the story, I guess. However, they did, now as I think back on it, I'm like, yeah, the crisis moment in both cases is much watered down because it's much less of a crisis of faith and more of a crisis or moral, either one. But like it was more of a romantic crisis, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that did, it lessened it, which I didn't realize at the time. But like reading it through this time, I was like, well, that's a lot happening in this turmoil. So I read it, and indeed I thoroughly enjoyed it this time. This time I did choose an audiobook for it, and I think both previous times that I had tried to read it, I had started with a print copy, and it was great. I also expected, based on my previous experience, I expected to like sort of, it was going to be one of those that I would have to sort of suffer through the beginning, but then it would sort of take off. But no, I actually like, it caught my interest from the very beginning. And, you know, with Jane as a small child going through these struggles and challenges. Anyway, so it was that part I thoroughly enjoyed. I liked it the whole way through.
Excellent.
So it's a winner.
I did love when Jane first meets Mr. Rochester on the road. That part, that scene, I was like, oh, this is, it's him. I know it's him. And he's, it's, it was so good.
For me, I first read the book, I think, as a teenager. Mm-hmm. I had, after encountering the 1996 BBC miniseries of Pride and Prejudice on vacation in Hatteras, North Carolina. I remember the Hurricane Edward came through, so we couldn't swim in the beach. And so I just watched TV all week, and this was on TV. But that led to me tearing through all the available Jane Austen novels I could get my hands on. Uh-huh. And after I finished them, it was like, okay, now what? Well, I guess there were other well-known female writers writing kind of romantic books at the same time. I'll try this instead. What, Nelly? Not the same thing.
No.
And I think because I was hoping it would be another Pride and Prejudice, and it wasn't, and I did not fully appreciate the book. Like, I enjoyed it. Of all the Bronte sisters, I think this is my favorite because it's so hopeful. Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte is just bleak. I've actually read The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. I've read one of Charlotte Bronte's other books, Villette, which was very good. But this one is special. But I was unable to appreciate it at the time because there was no Lizzie Bennet. Jane Eyre, not Lizzie Bennet. Okay,
no,
whatever.
No.
So fast forward like 2 decades and I pick it up and I read it and I'm like, wow, this is good. And then I set it aside again. But last fall, the reason we did this book club now, I fell, I hurt my knee. I basically was laid up for like 6 weeks, which is very frustrating for me. I don't like doing that. So I picked up Jane Eyre yet again. And I was just, maybe I was in a more spiritually receptive state because of the injury at the time. But I just remember being blown away by the depth of the content of the character and especially of all those moral and religious lessons, which you're right, Aaron, are completely left out of scholarly discussion generally, secular scholarly discussion, and completely left out of even the film versions that do a very faithful job of relating the book's dialogue and action. They leave out a lot of the inner dialogue, which is where all these faith struggles take place. And so that was why I came out of that experience going, oh, we got to do this for book club. There's so much there. And if you, like me, just read Jane Eyre as a teenager, just read it for the romance, the creepy crawly vibe of the mad woman in the attic, the happy ending, whatever, go back and reread it as a fully mature adult who's done a little more living, because I think you too will just be astounded at what's there.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not perfect. I mean, and we might talk about this later, but I don't think Charlotte Bronte would necessarily pass LCMS doctoral review in all points. She had a few sort of heterodox ideas, but for the most part, she's a typical, faithful, old school Anglican clergyman's daughter. And she had a deep faith of her own. And that comes through. She was shameless about putting in, I think she couldn't imagine writing a book that didn't involve these themes of moral struggle, of providence, of all of these things, forgiveness and all the rest. So yeah, I love the book more today than I ever have, and I'll probably read it again in the next few years just to pick up even more things that I missed.
No, I'm sure this will be one that I will end up reading again. I'm a big fan of rereading books that I enjoy, and this one is dense enough that I know I will pick up on things that I forgot or, you know, didn't even realize were important the first time through and see more connections again. So,
and I definitely appreciated doing this in book club because I think a lot of people are familiar with this book. A lot of people really enjoyed the opportunity to revisit the book. And there were a lot of people who showed up who said, this is my favorite book. I have read this umpteen times.
And
I'm so glad I get to talk about it. So we had this last week, we had 45 women show up for our book club online. Nice. And some amazing and very in-depth discussions of the various content. I asked a couple more questions than I sometimes do throughout the week because I kept not being able to decide between one question or the other. Well, why not both? And even at the end, there's like, I don't know, half a dozen things I wish we could have talked about that we didn't. But we did cover a lot of ground. So as we often do, I will ask each of you, were there any questions that were discussed during our online book club that you'd really like to dig into a little bit more in depth here?
Let's talk about Jane's love life.
Let's see. Okay, we went there.
Yeah, of course, because I mean, Rochester and then St. John, I mean, it's like a huge storyline of will she or won't she end up with a man, and which one is it going to be, and how is it going to affect her life, and how is she going to choose, and all of these things. And there's just a lot. It's very complex. So question three, how comfortable are we with Jane and Rochester's romance? You ask a lot of very fair things of all of the red flags, like the power differential, because he's her boss and she's just doesn't know a lot about the world because she was at boarding school and he's been all over the place and also has a child, right?
And yes. He says it's not his.
Right.
But he can't say for sure.
Wink, wink. It's not. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. We all know what that means. He's rich. She's definitely not. Like, there's just so many differences. Honestly, I don't know that I have actually settled on anything. It's very interesting to think about because on the surface, like when you put all of the red flags down, it's a hard pass because like they're just so different. Mm-hmm. And yet when you read how their characters interact, like I kept forgetting about the age difference actually.
Yeah.
Because it's what, 25 years, 30 years.
So throughout the book, he is 35 and she is 18.
Okay.
Which is, you know, a similar age. It's less of an age difference than shows up in, say, a book like Emma.
Yeah. Mm. So that's what, 17 years? Did I do that math right? Okay. So like, it's a lot, but it's not quite creepy level of a lot. Like, right. He is old enough to be her dad, but not by like a ton of years. It's not like they're, you know, 30 or 40 years difference. That would be weird. Mm-hmm. So like the age difference I kept forgetting about because intellectually and like what goes on in their brains, they are on the same playing field and they did offset each other very well. And like the relationship was more than just like, you're a woman and so I want to end up with you at the end. It was a lot more of a slow burn of an intellectual kind of relationship. And I don't know, I found that really fascinating. And so I'm not mad that they ended up together. Definitely better than St. John got weird very quickly. And when he proposed to her and wanted her to go on the mission field with her as his wife. And I don't, that whole thing was just like,
even though he knew it would probably kill her.
Yeah.
Like he knew that. And he knew that she would never love him and he would never love her. But
yeah.
And she offered to go as his secretary. And he's like, no, that's a bad look. You should be my wife.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just it like that was just tacky. By the way, sorry I didn't say this earlier. Spoilers.
Oh.
Spoilers. If you haven't read the book and don't want spoilers, don't listen to this episode. Run away.
Who would listen to a book club episode if they don't want spoilers? Shame on you, listener. Shame on you.
I suppose that's more of a theology thing with St. John's gaslighting too. Like that was one of the biggest theological points. I was like, whoa.
So the interesting, you mentioned St. John's gaslighting, his manipulation, but the truth is Rochester also is guilty of some massive manipulation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Especially, I mean, aside from all the lies, like, oh, I've never been married. I don't have a crazy wife up in the attic who's going to completely throw a wrench in this plot.
That's a problem. Like that's one of the biggest like unbelievable parts of this for me personally is like if someone lies to me that much about something that fundamental in their lives, like that's going to be like, how do you trust that person again? So,
well, and that is Jane's superpower that she learns. And that's why all that dark stuff at the beginning of the book is really necessary to show that she has been truly wronged and doesn't know how to get over it. And then Helen Burns, her whole function is she teaches Jane how to get over it and forgive.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And be free in the forgiveness that comes just naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So that part of the story is not irrelevant to the overall plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because otherwise we cannot explain how Jane could possibly forgive this. I mean, even aside from the crazy wife in the attic, there's also, don't forget the Blanche Ingram, like weeks of life. He invites his whole party.
Specifically
for the and basically courts a rich, beautiful woman who is nothing like Jane.
For
the sake of manipulating Jane into making her jealous. I mean, that's what does that?
Like, the more we talk about him, the more I'm like, oh, no, there's someone better.
But and so that, I think, is something we need to acknowledge. Jane considers herself worthless, but the truth is she doesn't deserve either of the guys that comes after her.
Whoa.
And they do. They come after her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did notice something that adds to the creepy factor, but also explains a lot of this. This time, this was one of the last comments I put up earlier today in our thread. Did you see it? Where Jane is, there's no mystery as to why he loves her. She is exactly the opposite of Bertha.
Oh, yeah.
In every way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from tall, powerful, dark to pale, short, thin, delicate.
Does he actually love her even?
We'll see. What's that?
So does he actually even love her, or does he love the idea? Like, he loves the opposite.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I wondered that a lot.
I loved it. I did not love Rochester.
Yeah.
I am not especially thrilled with how it ended. I still loved the book, but I did not find myself being, I was not one of those that was like, oh, how will they ever end up together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Honestly, I was hoping there was a third option that was going to randomly happen. That would have been
we had one suitor and he didn't work out, and then we had another suitor, surprise, also didn't work out. Third time's the charm, right?
I honestly was hoping that, especially the way St. John and her ended. I was like, this is just weird. Like, she's got to win somewhere along the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the mystical voices over the plains.
She does get a third option. The Rochester at the end is very, very different.
Oh, that's true. Oh, right. I forgot about all of that.
He is no longer the strong, powerful lord of the manor. Right.
Yeah, that's true.
His manor has burnt down.
Right.
His strength is gone. His he's totally blind and dependent.
I forgot.
He's depressed. He's surly. He's single.
Yay. Question mark.
He is humbled by everything that has happened, and he has finally, most importantly, turned a repentant heart to God.
Yeah.
Like, this is not the same man
that
she left. And so I think that's where I like to leave the Jane Rochester relationship, is realizing she does get option three.
Yeah.
And it's different and better. And also the power dynamic is gone, because she has, in the meantime, become independently wealthy.
Yep.
Seen a lot more of the world than she had before, and she's got family.
Completely flipped. It's like, it's no longer, yes, there's a power dynamic. Now Jane has all the power, is what it is.
Feminism.
It didn't make for an equality.
Yeah.
It flipped it. It completely reversed it.
Don't get him wrong. Rochester's still filthy rich. He's just depressed and living in his second home.
Oh, poor guy.
But there is this sort of making the rough places plain in this, where Jane is raised up, where she had no family, she now has family.
Mm-hmm.
Where she had no money, she now has money. When she had no real life experience, well, now she really does.
Yeah.
And Rochester, exactly the opposite. He has lost and been brought down. And so now, whereas they always were, in some sense, intellectual equals and equal in worth and dignity, now they're closer to being equal in all the other ways as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really neat twist at the end, because then you can be sort of more at peace with it. At least I can.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah. So. I don't know. I'm still conflicted about the whole thing.
Yeah, fair enough. It's kind of weird.
I enjoyed reading it.
Uh-huh.
It's a reminder too, like, we read through the lens of our own culture.
Absolutely.
And our culture says that there is a There is an age limit over which it's weird and creepy if you get married. That there should be, you know, in this, and I started off the question by putting us within the post-hashtag Me Too context, where everyone is hypersensitive to any sort of power imbalance in a romantic relationship.
Yeah.
But that was not the case, you know, 150 years ago, that's 180 true. Years ago.
Right.
Where older men, younger women were very common, where financially independent men and more dependent women, very common, that wasn't necessarily a deal breaker for a very happy marriage.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So it's good to sort out our lenses.
That intellectual compatibility really came through strongly. And that didn't really, that didn't change. Like they were still the same intellectually compatible people by the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like that part doesn't make me mad because it's nice to have, I mean, your life, the person you spend your life with, it's good to have that intellectual compatibility too.
So. And that I think is created both by the fact that Jane is extraordinarily sensitive and mature beyond her years.
Yeah.
Thanks again, partly to Helen Burns and of course Miss Temple and all the early struggles that she had to overcome. Yeah. And Mr. Rochester is in many ways in a state of arrested development.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Where his troubles with Bertha basically caused him to hit pause on any sort of moral, spiritual, or emotional development for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they really are intellectually on the same level.
Yeah. Which is why I kept forgetting about the huge age difference.
Yeah.
They bring it up and I'd be like, oh, right, he's old and she's young. And yes, exactly why you said.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll probably never be completely at peace with this, but
no. You know. I mean, this is why it will be a great book to go back and reread.
Yeah.
Because like first take, and then I'll be like looking for more of the stuff to see, where do I see it?
Mm-hmm. I will say rereading the book as a middle-aged woman is one big thing has been removed, because when I was a teenager, I was like, dude, he's so old. And now I'm like, 35 is not old.
No. Uh-huh.
He is in the prime of life.
Now you're like, oh, she's so young.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, Erin, what else do we need to talk about here?
Okay. So I was contemplating either... You asked some great questions, Rachel, honestly.
Yeah.
So I was contemplating either question two about what does it mean to be a woman? What do we see in this book? Or question five, which is the theology of Jane Eyre.
Now you see why there were so many questions.
I know. I mean,
it's a long book. There's a lot in here.
There is. So maybe we'll go with the theology of it.
Okay.
How would you describe the theology of Jane Eyre? And I remember the first thing that, as I was reading it, that the first time that I was like, what? Was when she was a small child, or not small, but like she was a child and still living at her aunt's house. And Mr. Brocklehurst, Reverend Brocklehurst, came and was asking her, like, do you read the Bible? And she was like, yes, I love Daniel and Revelation. And I don't know, some other book, but one of the other, I'm like, What child reads those books as like, these are my favorite?
Yeah. I mean, Genesis, and Daniel, and Revelation are more spicy than some parts.
They are, but also just like, those are the ones that you just sit down and read for fun, as opposed to like, those are clearly the ones that, yes, she just came across herself. But later with Helen, she's like, have you read the Gospels? And she's like, no. And I'm like, what? How have you not? You went straight to Revelation and skipped
Doesn't
right
Doesn't everyone, though? Like, this is so true to life. Kids, you give them a Bible and they are not going to necessarily go straight to the Gospel of John.
Yeah. Well, that there, though, is like, so clearly she was not given... She was not given instruction, because you don't mm-hmm. start out by just thumbing through the Bible and that's how you learn about it.
Yeah.
If you're given instruction, if you're given instruction, you get the introductory parts. You get Genesis. You get Luke. You get
Jesus. Like, you get
the stories. You get Jesus. you get the stories that help you understand like how it all fits together. But you don't get the confusing prophetic dream passages. Those you get when you're just flipping through it on your own and your attention is caught by mention of, you know, fire and demons and angels, and you're like, "Woo, my imagination is going wow." Right. So she didn't have instruction, clearly. So she found this just on her own by flipping through and noticing interesting things. So that was interesting. And then when Helen came along and just like blew her eyes open with how could she be responding in this way to this sort of treatment, she's just gonna take it.
Yeah.
I mean, Jane with her aunt, Jane was horrible with her aunt. Her aunt was horrible to her, but also like that was a horrible way to speak to her aunt. And so later yes. she went and she asked forgiveness. Excellent. But she had no idea that that would be somehow inappropriate way to interact with her aunt until later, when she mm-hmm. sees Helen enduring this really hard treatment and just taking it, because mm-hmm. that's what we do as Christians. We,
yeah.
You know, where you're right. I could be better. I'm a poor, miserable sinner. And thank you for helping me improve.
Yeah. Yeah, that attitude is amazing. And I think it's just from a Lutheran perspective, you look at Jane's upbringing, and in some ways she was taught so much that is either wrong or incomplete about Christianity in mm-hmm. terms of, you know, not much beyond sinners go to hell. You don't want to go to hell. You better be good.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in her boarding school life, she's exposed to extraordinary amounts of scripture
mm-hmm.
that they recite the Sermon yeah. on the Mount together every yeah. week, that they hear, you know, essays and sermons and prayers mm-hmm. and large portions of scripture. The word of God does not return to him void.
Yep. Absolutely.
You can see yeah. through this exposure, even yes. though Jane lives through some horrific things during her school years, which, by the way, are semi-autobiographical.
Mm.
Charlotte Bronte herself was sent with her sisters to the clergy daughter's school at Cowanbridge in Lancaster.
Interesting.
And Charlotte, this is from Wikipedia, Charlotte maintained that the school's poor conditions permanently affected her health and physical development, and hastened the death of her two older sisters, who both died of TB that May. I mean, like this, the most outlandish part of the book is completely true. My mother was telling me, because she's a huge, huge Charlotte Bronte fan.
Uh-huh.
And we were nerding out about it because she's visiting this week.
Aww.
And she said, you know that the book, when it was first presented to be published, had to be revised to remove some of the more telling markers that would have let everyone know what this school was.
Oh no.
It was apparently a huge scandal.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so she had to go back and make it a little bit more ambiguous, but everyone still knew.
Yikes.
So yeah, that is, she goes through some extraordinary suffering, but she does so completely inundated
yeah.
with the word. And as right. a result, what does she come out of that with? A sense of resilience, of hope, mm-hmm. of trust,
yeah.
of moral backbone. And this amazing superpower, this ability to forgive people mm-hmm. who do not want to be forgiven, mm-hmm. do not deserve to be forgiven. And yet she just, without even thinking, says, I forgive you.
Mm-hmm.
So something went right
yeah.
in her yeah. upbringing yeah. that is yeah. pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. With the whole, like, when the reveal came, the impression I have, the reveal of Bertha as mm-hmm. as the mm-hmm. wife, the impression I have is that, and I'll look at this when I read it again, is that essentially Jane forgave Rochester immediately.
Yeah. Like, oh yeah, she absolutely did.
There wasn't even like a time of like the like just the bleeding betrayal hurt sort of thing. She moved right to forgiveness.
Yeah.
And then the main grief she had was, I cannot stay here. Mm-hmm. Not you made me leave, but mm-hmm. I cannot stay here. And I'm completely sorrowful that I have to leave you. And I'm so sad to be grieving that loss. No sense of because of what you did.
Yeah. You manipulated me. So you lied me to lied to me.
I like none of that. She moved right to forgiveness. And that also, like, she doesn't explain that. The author does not like explain her thought process. The author doesn't call it out to that extent. You have to sort of read that simply by the actions of what she's doing. Mm-hmm. She does give us a lot of her other thoughts, and it's never on, I have been betrayed. I've been wronged. None of that. And so that, for as much as the book does often feel heavy on law and morals, you get, when you read in between the lines, you can see that that's only because of the steadfast faith that she has that's supporting her and allowing her mm-hmm. to move on in this with grace and dignity and
And I think there is a lot of law, especially at the when her relationship with Rochester comes temporarily crashing to an end, because that's exactly what is needed in that situation.
Absolutely.
You know, he keeps asking her, "Well, run away with me.
Live
like man and wife, even though I can't marry you for real." And she's like, "I can't. Uh-huh. I just can't." Like, how many women have lived through that exact conversation?
Yeah.
And I love this part of the right before they part, and he says, "Are you going to leave me?" And she goes, "Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, mm-hmm. I'm going to leave you."
Yeah.
And he says, "What shall I do, Jane? Where turn for a companion and for some hope?"
Yes.
She says, "Do as I do. Trust in God and yourself. Uh-huh. Believe in heaven. Hope to meet there again." "Then you will not yield?" "No." "Then you condemn me to live wretched and die accursed?" His voice rose. "I advise you to live sinless, and I wish you to die tranquil."
Yeah.
Like, this is Jane Eyre. This is why we love her. This is why he loves her.
I know.
Because he needs this.
Incredible.
He doesn't. Yeah.
I could.
He doesn't want to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
I wish to die tranquil. Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. But throughout that conversation, like, even think about her concern for Blanche Ingram, her snooty, soulless rival, where she says, "Are you sure Blanche wasn't hurt by you pretending to be in love with her for all that time?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, she's fine. Are you sure?" Like, Jane has such a heart of compassion for, again, people who don't deserve it.
Yeah.
But they're the people, you talk about Lutheran concept of vocation, they're the people God has put in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people she serves, those are the people she loves and offers forgiveness to when they need it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is always.
Yeah. I mean, you see it also in her, like, immediate, it doesn't appear that she had any, the author doesn't tell us any other considerations she gave, but when she received the inheritance, she was immediately like, "Oh, I'm sharing this with my cousins."
And they're like, "No, you can't." She's like, "Yeah, watch me. I already did."
This is exactly what I would do. I would share this immediately. And he's like, no, you should stop a moment and think about it. No. This is what I want.
You're being
this
a silly is, woman.
This is who I am.
And then there's that great scene where she is like just at the end of her strength in the rain on St. John's doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
And he is, creep that he is, standing in the background, watches Hannah turn her away from the door, listens to that conversation, watches her a while longer, and there she is. She's just sitting there, and she says out loud, because she didn't think anyone was listening, "I can but die, and I believe in God. Let me try to wait his will in silence." She doesn't think anyone hears her but God.
Mm-hmm.
And St. John, of course, hears her. He's like, oh, okay, I guess she's on the up and up. Let's get you in and get you better. You're not a beggar woman after all. You know? That's like...
yeah.
But yes, because think about what kind of faith it would take to walk away from the only man you've ever loved, the only home you have, every bit of money, all of your possessions,
mm-hmm.
your future. She's not taking a reference away with her because she doesn't want to be found. She doesn't right. want him to know where she is. So right. she can't easily just move into other employment. She's losing her job. Mm-hmm. She has no family. She has nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to walk away from all of that when he promised her, you know, a really cushy life as his mistress.
Yeah.
But to say, I can't go against the will of God here. I just have to go and trust right. and trust that he will somehow take care of me, somehow make this mm-hmm. all work out.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. so I see a lot of Romans 8:28 here. We know that all things work together for good because in Jane's life, it actually happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why I think the providential realism is a really, mm-hmm. really fun reminder that even though we think we know exactly what's going to happen, that we can be really surprised sometimes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That checks out.
So this isn't on the theology topic. This is probably moving back to Sarah's the romance topic, but it just occurred to me that Rochester did this whole thing with poor Blanche Ingram specifically to make Jane jealous. And then she absolutely did the same thing to him.
Oh yeah.
She was recounting her time with the Rivers.
Yeah.
She was really leaning into it.
Yeah.
But that was like 2 days, not like 6 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, we talk about that power imbalance being absolutely, you know, evened out. And that's one example of
that's
it.
That's true. Yeah. Can I tell you the thing that annoyed me the most, though, other than St. John? And this is just Jane's character and maybe shows character flaws of my own. But when Rochester is trying to, like, get her a wedding dress and get her jewels and all of uh-huh. these things. And she's just refusing everything.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, Jane, let him love you. Come on. He wants to give you gifts and uh-huh. and like show you that he actually cares. I mean, he still has his wife in the attic, but like he wants to do this stuff. Like, let him.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. That's probably just my own personal soapbox. But and it's her character, you know, to be very just humble uh-huh. and not think that she doesn't deserve things, which I mean, okay, but I don't know. I was getting annoyed at the consistent, like, oh no, I don't deserve any of this. Like, well, okay.
Of course, what she was really doing was to ask him to love her as she was.
Mm.
Yeah.
And not to love her for what he could make of her.
Yeah,
and then eventually she does meet him in the middle. You know, she's got that lovely pearl gray silk dress, which honestly, I'd rather have that than a flashy pink thing myself. I can relate.
See, this is probably just me and my own character reading into her character.
You wanted the big frilly pink dress, didn't you?
I would have worn it.
And all the jewels. All the bling.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. Maybe I don't really grasp that concept of being like, no, I'll take the less frilly thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was all.
Before we close the conversation on faith and theology, I think we really need to talk about Rochester and his turn. The thing that actually is the only thing that could have made him worthy of Jane.
Yeah.
And that is this wonderful paragraph where he's relating what happened after she left him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the ultimate act of the law, the cuttingness of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
He says, Jane, you think me, I dare say, an irreligious dog, which... fair.
It was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But my heart swells with gratitude to the beneficent God of this earth just now. He sees not as man sees, but far clearer, judges not as man judges, but far more wisely. I did wrong. I would have sullied my innocent flower, breathed guilt on its purity. The omnipotence snatched it from me. I, in my stiff-necked rebellion, almost cursed the dispensation. Instead of bending to the decree, I defied it. Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
Divine justice pursued its course. Disasters came thick on me. I was forced to pass through the valley of the shadow of death. His chastisements are mighty, and one smote me which has humbled me forever. You know I was proud of my strength, but what is it now, when I must give it over to foreign guidance as a child does its weakness? Of late, Jane, only of late, I began to see and acknowledge the hand of God in my doom. I began to experience remorse, repentance, the wish for reconcilement to my Maker. I began sometimes to pray. Very brief prayers they were, but very sincere. Some days since, nay, I can number them, 4. It was last Monday night. A singular mood came over me, one in which grief replaced frenzy, sorrow, sullenness. I had long had the impression that since I could nowhere find you, you must be dead. Late that night, perhaps it might be between 11 and 12 o'clock, ere I retired to my dreary rest, I supplicated God that if it seemed good to him, I might soon be taken from this life and admitted to the world to come, where there was still hope of rejoining Jane. I mean, this change, mm-hmm. you know, this man who felt no remorse and suddenly feels remorse.
Yeah.
Who was an irreligious dog, but suddenly is praying all the time. I mean, this is the work of God in his life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite moments in the book, even though, Sarah, it is also the setup for your least favorite moment. Voice comes echoing across the moors in the night. Jane!
Oh, you hated that moment.
I rolled my eyes so hard. Oh. I was like, this is coming out of nowhere. Like,
really? Really?
Yeah. We should say that, and this was something that one of our fellow book club friends pointed out in the book, there is not quite enough gospel in this book, and there is like almost no Jesus.
Yeah.
So it's an incomplete kind of theology. Yeah. But for what it is, this theology of, you know, you've got sin, you've got righteousness, you've got trust, faith, repentance, remorse, forgiveness, reconciliation, providence. I mean, there's a lot here that we can, like Mr. Rochester, feel a real sense of gratitude for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One other thing that does occur to me, like the whole part with the fire and the fact that he essentially risked his life to attempt to save Bertha.
Yes.
You could see that as like, that's one of the signs of his conversion, his the change in him, the, you know, willingness to risk your life for somebody that has done you wrong and
made your life a living hell.
Yeah
Quite literally.
And to pursue it and be like, well, I can't not. So
greater love, love hath no man.
None of it is explicit. It's all like gospel stuff is all implied in this one. You have to read for it. You don't get it set out clearly.
Yeah. And there are some real scoundrelly religious figures too. Mr. Brocklehurst and to some extent St. John. One of my favorite characters is Eliza Reed, the hyper rigid, routine oriented young woman who is planning to go convert to Catholicism and become a nun because she likes the lifestyle. And then you see her contrasted with her sister, who is the polar opposite, you know, lazy, indolent, vanity driven party animal. And I think Charlotte Bronte's message is pursue a course somewhere in between these two extremes. So we've got some scoundrelly religious characters, but a lot of people exercising true faith. I love that Jane at one point, it explicitly says that she's interrupting Mrs. Fairfax's Bible time for a heart-to-heart discussion. Like this was a regular thing for her. So it's really nice to see a book taking place in a Christian cosmos that feels really authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mix of good and bad.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Okay. I could absolutely talk about this all day, but we need to pick a new book.
Yeah.
Direction shall we go?
Well, I think it's time we did some like nonfiction.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of fiction lately. And of course, we did the wonderful Meditations book, which is nonfiction, but old nonfiction. How about we tackle some new nonfiction?
New nonfiction.
Here for
it's been a couple of years since we did that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And this has actually been a season of reading a surprising amount of nonfiction for me and like brand new nonfiction.
Interesting.
Something about the political season made me want to read a lot about the issues and the people that are sort of like headlining our world right now. Mm-hmm. And so I've actually read all or part of 5 different nonfiction books in the last 3 months. Wow. Is, like I said, really unusual. So I'll go over all of them and tell you why we're not picking them. But, it, you know, they were all interesting, all definitely helped me understand the world better.
Okay.
And the political milieu in which we currently find ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we'll go in order from least to most likely to be our next book club pick.
Okay.
All right. So number five, coming in at number five, would be Pete Hegseth's The War on Warriors, Behind the Betrayal of the Men Who Keep Us Free. I have what you might call a professional interest in this book because my husband is a military chaplain and Pete Hegseth is currently undergoing Senate confirmation hearings to be our next Secretary of Defense, which is my husband's boss's boss. I don't know how many. But so I want to know who this guy was and what he stands for. And it's a really interesting book, especially if any one of our listeners has been either in the military or like I am military adjacent over the last 20 years and has noticed a cultural shift and has been concerned about it and wants some sort of clear-eyed analysis, very frank analysis of what's happening and what needs to change in order for our military to get back to what Pete Hegseth will characterize as its core mission of lethality. You know, a military that actually fights and wins wars rather than, you know, fights and wins culture wars or loses culture wars. I don't know. Anyway, this was really interesting. We will not be reading it together as a group because Pete Hegseth cusses like a service member. And I found his use of language highly distracting in parts of the book. And so I would not necessarily recommend it to our younger audience members. But like I said, if you, like me, have a professional interest in the current, the past, present, and possibly future state of our military, this is a good place to start. And it's a quick read, too. All right. Next, we have number four. Same basic theme. This is Vivek Ramaswamy's book, Truths, The Future of America First. So this was one that I read at the recommendation of my mother, and she actually bought it as a gift for my son, who's a government major. And I read it first, because that's how we do here. And this was a really, really good, really clear-eyed take on a variety of issues facing our society. Things like Chapter one, God is real.
Okay.
Chapter two, the climate change agenda is a hoax.
Oh boy.
Chapter three, an open border is not a border. Chapter four, there are two genders. Chapter five, there are three branches of US government, not four. Chapter six, the nuclear family is the greatest form of government known to mankind. Chapter seven, reverse racism is racism. Chapter eight, nationalism isn't a bad word. Chapter nine, facts are not conspiracies. In Chapter 10, the U.S. government is the strongest guarantor of freedom in history. All right. So like I said, a wide-ranging book on a variety of contemporary issues. But you see Vivek Ramaswamy as a voice that is very close in, though not as close as he was 2 weeks ago, to the core of leaders who are currently working to correct what many, including me, feel are some excesses in our governmental system. And so whether you agree with this platform or not, it's really helpful to be able to read about it and understand it from the inside. And that's where a book like this is really helpful. Because as far as I know, President Trump himself has not authored a book of this kind. So we have no ability to peer inside his own brain in the same way. So and a really interesting read. Number three, speaking of the Trump administration, I finally, after like 8 years of planning to read it, got around to reading J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, which is a beautiful book. It would be a great book club book if we're looking for really interesting things to talk about. The reason I wouldn't recommend it as a book club book is largely because, again, content issues. This is a really honest and clear-eyed look at a very troubled childhood and, you know, there's issues of, you know, drug abuse, broken relationships, a lot of language, things like that in there that I think would not make it great for our group in particular.
Yeah.
But again, I really enjoyed being able to understand the man who stood up and took the oath of office as mm-hmm. our vice president on January 20th. And it's a really, really insightful look at a significant subculture within America.
Yeah.
Okay. That brings us to number two. And this one would have been a contender. And it might be a contender in the future. Just putting it out there because this is a really, really interesting book. It is called Get Married, Why Americans Must Defy the Elites, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization by Brad Wilcox. And believe it or not, this is not a Christian book. This is a secular take on the state of marriage in America and why marriage is such an important institution, because there has been a lot of anti-family messaging that has come out over the last few decades. You know, save the planet, don't have kids. Why would you give up your freedom and independence in marriage? Marriage is the killer of romance. All sorts of mixed and negative messages that have come out about this. And yet, I think Brad Wilcox very helpfully points out all of the old wisdom and the new science that are really reinforcing what we would consider just a biblical view of how the world works best.
Yeah.
So that one's a really good one. I've only read three chapters in it so far because my oldest daughter stole it, and I am apparently allowed to finish it when she's done with it. So, so that's a great one. What I read of it is amazing, and I look forward to finishing it at some point in the future. Which brings us, drumroll please, to the book we are actually going to be reading together. And we all decided on this like a while ago because sounds cool. We need to read that.
A little disingenuous.
What's that?
The whole lead up of here's books we considered but aren't doing, and here's why we're not doing, because we already picked our book.
I know. I just wanted to give you something a little bit more meaty and substantive than just here's our book, have a nice day.
No, bye guys. I appreciate it. You gave some great ideas for people that might want to do additional reading on their own.
We'll call them bonus reads. Yeah. But this one is our actual book club book. And you're right, Erin. We totally picked this book pretty much before I even read any of the other books.
It was a while ago.
Okay, so here it is. We are going to be reading together a newish book called The Anxious Generation.
Yay,
how the great rewiring of childhood is causing an epidemic of mental illness. This is by Jonathan Haidt. And it's available wherever you get your books. This is not one you're going to have to look far to find.
Yeah.
It's available in Kindle and audio and probably on all of your favorite library sites. It's everywhere. And a lot of people are talking about it, but we want to talk about it too.
Yep.
So, Sarah, you were the one who originally recommended this book to us. Tell us why you popped it into our discussion thread and said, hey, we need to read this book.
Right.
Mostly because my very close, trustworthy friend was reading it, and she kept sending me screenshots, and she's like, you guys have to do this book because it is so good and is so applicable and talks about so many things. And she was already implementing some of the stuff that it was saying about screen time and kids and even for adults. Like, even if you don't have kids, there are things that make sense about how we view screens in our lives and technology in general, and just how we kind of just tend to go along with how we always do things and how much this phone literally stays glued to my side all day. And that's really not actually good for me. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be a bit of, it might make you rethink some things, but I think that's okay. If you
are like me in the trenches with kids, you've already been rethinking things.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
In fact, a lot of what I've seen in the book so far sort of corresponds to some heavy thinking I was doing several years ago and some changes we were making even then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
I'll save that information for when we talk about the book in a couple of months.
That's right.
Yeah.
But this is one of the number one cultural topics that we have got to deal with in this generation.
Yeah.
Because let's see, what does the subtitle say? It's causing an epidemic of mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even talk about the spiritual stuff, which is just as bad.
I mean, even as an adult, I know when I spend less time on my phone and less time scrolling, I'm generally a better person. So, like,
and a happier one.
And a less anxious one. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, it depends what I'm doing on my phone. So there is some nuance as an adult to about what I'm doing. But in general, mm-hmm. like if I'm doing Duolingo and learning Portuguese, like that's fun. But I'm still staring at my phone, which is not great. If I'm scrolling Facebook and finding all these terrible reels about health yeah. problems that are dumping my mental health down the drain, that is bad. So there may be some nuance, but I think it'll be really good to just take a good hard look at these things in our lives, because I don't think that's ever really a bad thing.
We're already wanting to talk about it now, and we haven't even finished the book. So
stop it.
Press pause on this conversation, which is going to be very excellent and needful. And we'll have our next book club. I think we usually have the spring one in April. So watch for that when the time comes. April-ish. Sarah, you probably have a more exact date.
Yeah.
Anyway, about 3 months. Get the book now. You have time to read it. I'll try to remind you a little bit more ahead of time when we get closer to the actual book club time. When the time comes, we will have a book club discussion in the Lutheran Ladies Lounge Facebook group.
Yep.
If you have never been to one of these, they're great. They're easy. They're unlike most of the stuff you do on screens. This shouldn't add to your anxiety. So the way this works is you click through to our event page and you just RSVP going. There is no event. It's just a page that we can set up, and then all the conversations take place in the comments on the page, where I will post prompts and discussions and everyone gets to chime in. We're open for business for like 5 days. You have all that time to get in there, think through the questions, offer your own answers, read other people's answers, respond to other people's answers. And it's a really fun and low stress format for doing our book club. If you've never done one before, make this the one.
Yep.
It's going to be a great book.
As it stands right now, that episode is scheduled to drop April 11th, which means book club in the group would be March 30th through April 4th. We'll see.
Great.
If that.
Okay.
But as of right now.
Less than 3 months.
Yeah. As of right
now. Well,
because of where Easter falls, and we didn't want to do book club during mm-hmm. Holy Week because that
True.
Would be weird. So
yeah.
It's a little okay. Early. Well, I'll see you at the end of March then with The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. Back to you, Sarah.
Thanks, Rachel. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. I think every day on my social media, there's something new on screens and a video that keeps circulating about this experiment that a school did. And they took their phones away and the kids were magically happier after a little while. So you've got your details. We will have everything in our Facebook group. You can join us there, the Lutheran Ladies Lounge on Facebook. Also on our Instagram page at Lutheran Ladies Lounge. You can find all of our episodes at kfuo.org/Lutheran Ladies Lounge or on your favorite podcasting app or on the KFUO radio app. You're listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
Views and opinions expressed on the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast may not represent the official position of the management or ownership of KFUO Radio, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The Lutheran Ladies Lounge is produced by KFUO Radio and available at kfuo.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and leave a review for us too. If you love the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast, consider financially supporting our producer, KFUO Radio, so we can keep doing what we do. Find out how at kfuo.org/give.